Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 13, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call on recess appointments in the Supreme Court, National Labor Relations Board versus Noel Canning. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Mr. John Elwood, a partner at Vinson & Elkins, LLP. A more complete bio for our speaker was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Elwood, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, this is a fascinating case. As I've described this in the past as catnip for law nerds, I'm going to assume a fairly high level of familiarity with the case, but I'll give a brief background about what the case is all about. Of course, in January 2012, President Obama made recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board and of Richard Cordray to the Consumer Finance Protection Board, which managed to present all three of the kind of current recess appointment issues all at once. Now, as the case started out in the D.C. Circuit, it really seemed to focus on the validity of pro forma sessions because, as most people who are on this call probably are aware, since about 2007, the Senate has frequently or almost always engaged in so-called pro forma sessions in order to deny the president his ability to make recess appointments. And under this practice, usually a single member of the Senate goes in, bangs the gavel to bring the Senate into order, and then goes out within 30 seconds. And frequently, almost always, those orders say that no business, the recess orders say that no business is to be conducted at those pro forma sessions. And as the case went before the D.C. Circuit, that was really the only issue before them. That was most of the briefing was devoted to. But something funny happened on the way to the courthouse. The D.C. Circuit wound up invalidating the recess appointments of the NLRB members on much broader grounds. First, they held that the president lacked the authority to make recess appointments during so-called intra-session recesses, that is, the sessions that Congress, the recess that Congress takes in the middle of its sessions of Congress, such as the August recess and the Christmas recess, are both intra-session recesses, instead of the single inter-session recess between the two sessions of Congress nowadays. It's an issue that has been raised, you know, a fair amount recently. That's a basis on which Senator Kennedy challenged President Bush's recess appointments during the administration of President Bush number 43. Secondly, the D.C. Circuit held that the president only had the authority to make recess appointments when the vacancies, consistent with the clause, the recess appointments clause only says the president can fill up vacancies that happen during the recess of the Senate. And he, the D.C. Circuit, in an opinion by Judge Santel, interpreted that to mean he can only make recess appointments if the vacancy actually occurs for the first time during the recess, which was a much broader ground. And the executive branch has asserted since 1823 the authority to make recess appointments to vacancies that preexisted. Now, after that time, the Third Circuit and the Fourth Circuit both agreed on the intra-session recess point, but didn't manage to get to the happens to arise versus happens to arrest, happens to exist question. So, and that was the basis on which the NLRB sought review, was to review those two questions, intra-intra, and also happens to exist versus happens to arise. The challengers, Noel Canning, asked the court to add the pro forma sessions issue, and the court did it. So all three issues were before the court. To begin, I'll note a couple of things that may not be aware. I don't know what is being sort of tweeted about and blogged right now. But Senators McConnell, Session, and Mike Lee were all present. There may have been others, but those were the only ones I saw. As an interesting point that is both for, you know, for human interest and also because it is semi-relevant to the argument, recently confirmed Judge Patty Millett was in the courtroom. and she presented somebody for the admission to the bar, and the Chief Justice made a joke. But I think that that is potentially important because she was confirmed because the Senate changed its rules to essentially eliminate the filibuster. And I think that she kind of makes the challenger's case easier because it eliminates some of the parade of horribles for the administration that she, you know, that people like her even exist. And so the fact that she was present in the courtroom and was very much in people's attention, I think, may wind up eventually being significant. We'll have to see. As an overview of the argument, I will say that Don Verrilli, who argued on behalf of the government, had a much tougher time than the challengers. He was subject to much more frequent and skeptical questioning and than either of the people who argued for Noel Canning, that is Noel Francisco, or for the Republican senators, which was Miguel Estrada. Miguel Estrada in particular, although he's up for 15 minutes, which is a fair amount of time, got very few questions. Now, I'll break these up into kind of categories. First up is kind of general concerns that the various justices raised, which didn't really fit into any single category, but which are potentially significant. During a time when Solicitor General Verrilli was getting very few friendly questions, about the only people who got what might be deemed friendly questions he received from Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, who I think were the two votes that he's most likely to get, that the administration is most likely to get out of today's argument. Both of them came right out of the gate asking questions about the implications and whether holding for the challengers could call the actions of past recess appointees into dispute. Both of them asked questions of that sort. Justice Scalia then immediately came out saying, with a counter argument, you know, that surely, he said, you would argue that de facto officer doctrine would apply. And de facto officer doctrine is a doctrine that in this application would be a defense, essentially, if somebody was trying to challenge a particular recess appointed official's actions, that would be something that the government would be expected to invoke. And Scalia made it sound like this would not be much of a concern. When this was later asked, I think then by Justice Ginsburg of the advocate for Noel Canning, he gave a you know, a fairly full answer to why it really wouldn't be an issue. And people didn't seem to take very much dispute with that. They didn't seem to dispute his answer, which is that, you know, various agencies could ratify the decisions of the recess appointed official. And, you know, they have all sorts of defenses and statute of limitations things. So I think that whatever concerns there were about the practical implications of a ruling were effectively nullified. As an aside, I would note that if the court wound up ruling on the pro forma sessions ground, that would affect basically only the recess appointments to NLRB and possibly to the Cordray appointment. But, you know, Cordray was since confirmed, and I think that he would be a simple matter to ratify his previous actions. Indeed, he may already have done that. So the sort of practical concerns don't appear to be much of an issue. Also, I think it's important to note at the, you know, relatively early in my discussion that the government really has to run the table here, that if they lose on any one of the three grounds, the recess appointments are invalidated, whereas, you know, the challengers only have to win on one. And I think that that was kind of, you know, something that was very much evident during the argument. You know, when he stood up for rebuttal, Solicitor General Verrilli really had a lot of ground to cover. And he, it was evident that he didn't cover it all. He got too many questions, even though he had 6 minutes for rebuttal, which is an unusually long time, because the arguments were 45 minutes aside instead of the usual 30 minutes. Solicitor General Verrilli, he was trying always to portray the necessity of having the recess appointment power to fill, essentially to take care of emergencies. He gave the example of the Secretary of Labor dying right before recess in, I think, 1948. And Elena Kagan, who, you know, if the administration is going to have allies, I think that they would probably hope to have allies on among the Democratic appointees. But Elena Kagan was definitely, along with Justice Breyer, very much skeptical of the administration's position. And if she was identifiable with anybody, I think she seemed to be very sympathetic to the challenger's view. She said, you know, maybe this was intended for emergencies at the beginning, but now the recess appointment clause is mostly used for emergencies, not because of the Senate's absence, but because of the Senate's intransigence. And that was something she said, there's no such thing as a congressional absence anymore, which was something that was, you know, agreed to by people on, you know, among the court's more liberal members. Justice Ginsburg said later that its use wasn't really a tie to the availability of the Senate. She said, quote, to be candid, the Senate is always available, unquote. And so there seems to be a lot of skepticism that this is a necessary thing for emergencies. In a related vein, Justice Kagan said, you know, the original purpose, which is, you know, to fill offices during emergencies, has disappeared and assumed a new importance that was never intended by the framers, which was essentially to overcome sort of intransigence in the Senate. You know, definitely a lot of the traditional rationales for the administration's use or various administrations' use of recess appointments seem to encounter a great deal of skepticism on the court. There seem to be very few defenders and skepticism among appointees of every stripe. Justice Alito he said that Justice Solicitor General Verrilli was taking a, quote, a very aggressive argument, or making a very aggressive argument in favor of executive power. S.G. Verrilli argued that it was, you know, that basically this was consistent with the framers' views, that the framers were worried about self-aggrandizing Congress. And there is actually, you know, a lot to be said for that, that they thought that Congress would have so many reins that it would grab a lot of power. And the Chief Justice was unimpressed. He noted that the compromise, you know, when really invoked the idea that they didn't want to give appointments to the Senate or to the Congress, Roberts noted that the compromise was to take not to take it away from the Senate completely, but to give them the role in confirming to divide it up. And he noted that, you know, Congress and the executive branch came together to permit acting officers, which is another argument against emergency, by basically invoking the Vacancies Reform Act, which is a, you know, law passed by Congress that gives, in the executive branch at least, it doesn't work for multi-member agencies or multi-member boards. It gives the executive branch enormous flexibility to keep the government running by appointing people for, you know, as acting officers. Justice Breyer, and I thought this was very significant, said, you know, you have to look not just to the language of the Constitution, but also its purpose. And he said, I think this is a direct quote, the purpose of the clause has nothing to do with political fights, unquote. And he, you know, said, what have I missed, you know, that there's something in the Constitution that's supposed to let this to be used for political disagreements. You may recall that Justice Breyer used to be counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so, you know, even though he is a Democratic appointee, you know, he seemed to be thinking quite a lot about sort of the Senate's prerogatives. And, you know, he seemed to be very sympathetic to the Senate. And you couldn't just dispense with the Senate's ability to block nominees because the Senate was tying up various nominees that weren't to the president's liking. Now, during his argument for the members of the Senate, Republican members of the Senate, Miguel Estrada noted that in a nation of 300 million, you can always find an acceptable nominee. And there was very little resistance to that notion. There seemed to be, I mean, partly it was exhaustion by that point since it was nearing the end of a 90-minute argument. But there did seem to be a fair amount of agreement with what Mr. Estrada was saying on behalf of the Republican senators. One of the, you know, relative bright spots here was Justice Ginsburg asked a lawyer for Noel Canning, that is Noel Francisco, or rather commented that his interpretation would destroy the recess appointment clause as a practical matter. And I thought it was very interesting that Noel Francisco said, I may be misremembering this, but the first word out of his mouth was yes. But he emphasized that the recess appointment power was intended to be contingent power, and it was intended to be a contingent power that the Senate controlled, that the Senate could basically invoke it by going out for an intersession recess. And I think that the important thing there is that that argument encountered surprisingly little pushback. Now, I will begin with the happens to, well, let me see here. I will begin with inter-intra, because beforehand, I thought that this was a relatively unlikely ground on which the challengers would win, because I thought that the historical evidence wasn't as strong for this as it was for the other things. And so I thought that this was a relatively unlikely ground for the court to hold for the challengers. And I continue to agree with that position, although that does not mean that there was a lot of love for Solicitor General Verrilli's position. There did seem to be a fair amount of appreciation that the main reason why intra-session recess appointments hadn't been made earlier was because, just, you know, because of the way Congress worked and the fact that people have to go home to their home districts, that it wasn't very, you know, it wasn't very feasible. But there did seem to be a fair amount of appreciation that there wasn't much reason why you would want Congress to have the power, or rather have the, for the president to have a power to make intercession recess appointments, but not intra-session recess appointments. Several people, Kagan, who again was generally pretty favorable to the challengers, said, you know, basically intra-session recesses really only arose in the 1940s, and as soon as they came to be, the president started making recess appointments. Justice Breyer, who again was generally fairly favorable to the challengers, said, how are we supposed to say this is unconstitutional? Nowadays, for the first time ever, intra-session recesses are longer than inter-session. And he made the point that it's not unheard of for the language of the Constitution, you know, even assuming that there's a textual hook for the challenger's argument. He said it's not unheard of for the language of the Constitution to take on a different meaning over time, which, of course, provoked a thunderous response from Justice Scalia, who said that previously, when people had distorted the meaning of the words of the Constitution, it was the court that did it, not, you know, the practitioners outside it. One thing that surprised me was, Justice Alito, who was very skeptical to the administration's line throughout this, said, you know, does it matter if the framers never thought about intra-session recesses at the founding, because everyone would have to go home, and so it wasn't practical to have long intra-session recesses. But he said, is there any reason that the framers wouldn't have wanted the recess appointment power to apply? And Noel Francisco, who was, I think, extraordinarily well prepared, he gave a reasonable answer, but I still think that it seems like a relatively unlikely that the court will use this as the basis for invalidating the recess appointments. We will see, although they may feel that they have to respond to all of the arguments. That is, even if they went off on pro forma sessions or something, I could see that they might want to address every argument, just so that it isn't a matter of a pall being cast over recess appointments by all of the lower court opinions. I could see them doing that. I think it's more likely, though, that they'll have a fairly narrow argument. They'll do enough to decide these cases, but no more. Now, let me see here. Oh, there was one thing that I thought. There was one argument that I haven't mentioned so far, which was Justice Kennedy's, and which I thought was favorable to the challengers on the intra-intra point, which is he said that the SG's position was, quote, in search of a limiting principle, because he was like, you know, at some point, there's got to be a point at which the president can't make recess appointments. You can't make them over lunches. And Verrilli, even though the various administrations over time, the executive branch has at various times expressed skepticism that there is any limiting principle, that you could, you know, do it whenever, which is the position that the Justice Department has taken in district courts in the last 10 or 15 years, Verrilli invoked the adjournment clause, which says neither house can recess for more than 3 days without the consent of the other. And he said that that three-day period was a limiting factor, and below that, you know, you can, there isn't a recess appointment power for de minimis breaks of 3 days or less. And I have to say that the three-day period, I don't think, gives people a lot of comfort on the court. Like, people who are balancers, like Justice Kennedy, 3 days I don't think is going to give him a lot of comfort. If the SG might have said 10 days, I think the balancers, like Justice Kennedy, would have been more comfortable with the position. But I don't think 3 days is going to give anybody who's looking for a balance a lot of comfort. One thing that I thought that Solicitor General really made a questionable choice was he led off his rebuttal with the intra-session point, which, given that he did relatively well, you know, during Noel Francisco's argument, that is, his side did relatively well. It seemed like that was a strange place to begin because he does, again, have to win every point. So I would have probably begun on happens to arise versus happens to exist or pro forma recesses where he, you know, his side did worse, during Noel Francisco's argument. Now I will go to the second argument, that is the second question presented, the happens to arise versus happens to exist. There was a lot of skepticism on both sides of the aisle about the meaning of happening as a continuing sense. The administration argued that happens, that vacancies happen in a continuing sense, which I think is a less ridiculous argument than it sounds like, because the example I like to use is when did the last, vacancy in the office of the vice president happen, and maybe that was August 8th of 1973 when Nixon resigned, but maybe it was, August through December when the office was vacant. But there was broad skepticism that that vacancy was a continuing condition. Scalia or Justice Alito asked, "Is your appointment to Solicitor General still happening?" Scalia made a joke that a death happens in 1941. It doesn't continue in 1945. It's just that they're still dead. But your death doesn't happen in 1945 if you first died in 1941. Of course, peals of laughter there. Even Justice Breyer, who again was fairly skeptical of the administration's position, said, "Give me an example of a sentence using the word vacancies where it happens over time." And he didn't have my vice president example handy, apparently, but he said, really just sort of hemmed and hawed. And Breyer said, "I'm getting from your answer that you couldn't find an example." So, there is at least a broad perspective that happening, a vacancy happening as a continuing thing, there was not a lot of love for that position. But one kind of continuing thing was, there was a question of what happens to practice, because, as I said, the executive branch has been taking the position since at least 1823 that vacancies that, happen to continue to exist could be filled. And during the argument for this, the administration argued that, or it's the Solicitor General argued that, President Washington had made appointments that qualified for this, and that Jefferson had too. And even though the challengers, Noel Francisco and Noel Canning, disputed that, it seemed to be that either the justices were agreeing with the SG's reading of those appointments, or they were just giving him the benefit of the doubt for purposes of figuring out what happens then. And Scalia said very early during Verrilli's argument, "Suppose I agree with the Court of Appeals, about what the original language originally meant. What do you do with practice that flatly contradicts it?" And he referred to 200 years of practice, which suggests that he agrees with the challengers, or at least was giving them agrees with the administration, or was giving them the benefit of the doubt that President Washington made recess appointments that fit that mold. And Alito, too, during Noel Francisco's argument, said, "What do you do with 200 years of uninterrupted practice?" And invoked Scalia's question. And Kagan said, "I have the same issue as Justice Alito." The one thing is, though, that Noel Francisco's argument was that he reiterated that the most natural reading of the actual clause happened to go with them. That is, with the challengers. And he said he made the point that the branches can't consent to give up protections of the Constitution, that the Constitution was written and gave various branches of government various powers to protect the people, not to protect those branches. And this was one of the few bright lights, or at least a not as dim light for the Solicitor General, as the next couple of questions. Justice Sotomayor, who again, she and Ginsburg were the two most pro-SG justices, Sotomayor said, "This assumes that the reading of the clause is unequivocal." And he says, "Why can you assume that? At best, it's kind of, it goes both ways." And she noted, I believe that Thomas Jefferson said that, it was subject to two readings. And Noel Francisco argued that he got out a very good answer that everyone who spoke on it publicly disagreed. And he reiterated that, and I think that there, this is where they have relatively, you know, good authority, that there were that there was a lot of consensus in public statements that they didn't have the power to invoke it. And he noted that Jefferson, even though he said in a letter that it was equivocal, which, you know, that it was subject to two interpretations, that he held off on making racist appointments. And he noted that the Pay Act showed that the Senate didn't acquiesce into it. Justice Kagan, who again was generally fairly favorable to the challengers, said, you know, maybe it seems unambiguous to us, given our, you know, current interpretations of what the word happens mean, but maybe not at the time. And she talked about old-fashioned definitions of happens in the Oxford English Dictionary. And at that point, Breyer chimed in and, you know, noted that he had read the same definitions, but he noted that some of these definitions were considered obsolete for whatever that happens. I mean, it may not matter for originalists that it's obsolete now. Justice Kennedy noted at one point that in talking to Justice, in questioning Noel Francisco, the lawyer for the challengers, he said that the Senate appointment clause use of the word happens favored his position because it was clear that in the Senate appointment clause, which authorized governors to make appointments to Senate vacancies that happen during the recess, it clearly kind of pointed to when people die or, you know, vacate offices during the recess. And Noel Francisco, again, I thought handled that very effectively by invoking an example where the Senate had refused to seat a person that a governor named where the vacancy had not actually happened or had not arisen during the recess, but had continued into the recess and the vacancy had arisen beforehand. But this I thought was interesting. Earlier during the same argument, Kennedy said, assume the history is too overwhelming to rule on your favor of this happens to exist versus happens to arise. Could we still use history to rule in your favor on the intra question? Which is interesting. I think that Justice Kennedy is relatively friendly to the challengers on this intra point. Because one of the things he talked about was, how the Senate or how Congress had clearly interpreted the session to be the formal session of the Congress, you know, that lasts, you know, basically a whole year, and not the kind of informal things like, you know, between their lunch breaks. And he thought, he seemed to be buying the idea that the recess is in contradistinction to the Senate and that you can't have both the way you might in recognizing an intra-session recess. Anyway, to get back to the Kennedy's question, he said, could we still use history to rule in your favor on intra-intra? And Francisco said yes, and then picking up on what he had previously asked about, Kennedy had previously asked about, that it was kind of a dichotomous view that the recess was in contradistinction to the session. The Chief Justice said that when he was questioning Don Verrilli, said that the opponents, that is, the Noel Canning, says that their reading of the clause would make the phrase happens to arise superfluous, and that the government's proposed explanation that they had offered was future appointments. That happens to arise was in there to keep the president from filling up vacancies that they knew would happen later. And the Chief Justice ridiculed that idea, saying, you know, he'd ridiculed the idea that you needed that language to avoid appointments to vacancies that haven't happened yet. This may seem ridiculous to people who haven't followed it terribly closely, but I thought it was interesting because, you know, John Roberts was originally nominated to fill a vacancy that wouldn't happen yet. Remember, he was originally nominated to fill the vacancy of Justice O'Connor, who resigned effective on the qualification of a successor, meaning that she would not step down until her successor was filled. That is, her successor was already appointed. And, that is by definition a vacancy that doesn't happen yet. I don't think that the example was as ridiculous as John Roberts made it to be, but the fact that he thought it was ridiculous counts a lot because he has a vote and I don't. Let me see here. And Justice Breyer, again, who was relatively sympathetic to the challengers, said maybe they put that language in there, the happens to arise language, so that the president couldn't re-appoint all the people that the Senate wasn't willing to confirm, you know, basically to allow them to fill up, which is a very significant question for him to make, since that is basically what presidents have been using the re-appointment clause for, you know, decades. And one final point, Justice Breyer alone seemed to be interested in the fact that Congress, when it enacted the Pay Act, which was an act, you know, providing for the payment of Reese's appointees under certain circumstances, allowed payment for people who filled vacancies that arose within 30 days of when Congress went out, suggesting that he thought that that might provide Congress's gloss on when a vacancy arises, because, you know, one of the worst hypotheticals you can come up with is, you know, people who resign or die right before Congress goes out, but because under the challenger's reading, you wouldn't be able to fill those spots. So he is trying to strain, essentially, to come up with a theory under which the challenger's reading wouldn't give rise to kind of bad hypotheticals. But it is just a hypothetical, since, you know, you do have the ability to name people to offices on a acting basis outside of multi-member boards. So with that enormously long windup, I will get to pro forma sessions. Pro forma sessions was another area where Solicitor General really, really encountered tough sledding. You know, he started out immediately by emphasizing the fact that the recess order that began these recesses used the phrase "no business conducted," and he was very dismissive about that, saying, "You're talking about magic words." I know someone talked about the hypothetical of, you know, what if we just, you know, we won't do things unless it's really important or something like that. So, I mean, clearly he was not that impressed by the fact that they said no business conducted. And Kagan came up immediately after that by saying, you're not answering the real thrust here. And she said this to Don Verrilli. You know, if we go off on the fact that the recess order said no business conducted, we're just going to be back here when Congress phrases the recess order differently. And she took from it the fact that, you know, that mattered what they said, that it suggests that it's really up to the Senate and that it's the Senate's job to say whether they're in recess or not. And Justice Ginsburg also asked a question about what if they took out the no business conducted language. So, you know, there was a lot of attention given to that. Justice Kagan, again, seemed to be, she seemed to be very much leaning towards the challengers on the pro forma sessions issue, because she raised the hypothetical of, with Don Verrilli, what if the Senate came in but did trivial business every 3 days instead of addressing nominees, like they came in every 3 days and named another post office after someone. And, you know, when the Solicitor General agreed that that would be enough for their definition to make them available and not in recess, you know, she thought this was another example of the fact that, you know, you really should leave these matters to the Senate. Justice Alito also gave the example of what if they went out and said, you know, we aren't going to handle nominations during these sessions of Congress, but we're going to do other things. And I believe that Don Verrilli said that that would be enough to mean that they were in session. And, you know, so when both of those hypotheticals seemed to be just fine with the Solicitor General, there seemed to be a lot less enthusiasm for his position. Justice Breyer, again, another indication that he was really pretty challenger on this point. He noted that pro forma sessions had been used for other purposes for ages, that they had been used for purposes of satisfying the adjournment clause, again, that one house can't go out without for more than 3 days without the permission of the other. And he noted that they had been used to satisfy the various houses of Congress' duty to meet at least every 3 days if they don't have the permission of the other house to go out. And he noted that pro formas had been used for purposes of the 20th Amendment, which specifies that Congress has to meet on the 3rd of January every year. And Don Verrilli took the position, Breyer said that the Senate violate both of those constitutional provisions, and Verrilli made the argument that it was hard to see that they had been complied with. And Breyer, I think this is very significant, given that he's got to be one of the votes that that the Solicitor General needs in order to win here, said that it was more natural to think that the Senate had the ability to interpret the meaning of it under the Constitution because they have the ability to make rules. And, you know, it's really speaking to them. And so he suggested that you have to defer to the Senate's interpretation of the, of these words. Justice Sotomayor, again, gave a relatively rare lifeline to Don Verrilli, saying, you know, pointing out that the Senate could really stay in session. She said, you know, some citizens want it to. And she said, and this again got peals of laughter, she said, some people work every day, which I think was her way of pointing out that, you know, the Senate could, if they really want to frustrate recess appointments, they should be in there doing their job. So it suggests that she is one of the people who is relatively inclined to vote with the government in this case. Don Verrilli argued that it was important to not to disturb what he said had was a stable equilibrium. He argued that the branches of government had reached a stable equilibrium in both intra-session, their interpretation, that is that the president can make appointments to intra-session recesses, during intra-session recesses, and happens to arise versus happens to exist, that they had reached a stable equilibrium. And Elena Kagan said that if we look to the practice of the branches on those two, we have to look at it also, we have to look to the practices of the branches on pro forma sessions. And there was no historical practice of the president doing this. And Solicitor General Verrilli said that there was no long practice of allowing pro forma sessions to frustrate recess appointments either. And Alito came back immediately by saying that there was no practice rejecting that use either. And he noted that the president had signed legislation that had passed during pro forma sessions, noting that, I guess it was referring to the fact that the president signed legislation that had passed during a pro forma recess during the same period, during the same, you know, basically holiday recess period. It was before January 3rd, so it was the last Congress, supposedly, but it was in close proximity to, and in addition, the President Obama also signed legislation last August that was passed during another pro forma recess, which shows the consequences of the administration pushing pro forma recesses when they did, because it was a very bad time to do this. That had not happened during the Bush administration, that Congress passing legislation during a pro forma recess. And one final point, which is, a couple of people asked questions. Both Chief Justice Roberts asked questions about what if the Senate passes a rule saying we're never in recess, and I believe Justice Ginsburg asked a similar question later on. I think she asked it of Miguel Estrada, and Roberts asked it of Noel Francisco. And Noel Francisco argued that, you know, look at the Senate's journal to see whether they were actually in session. And if you look at the Senate's journal, which is, you know, it's something that the Constitution actually provides for, the Journal of the Houses of Congress, the journal says that they were in session. They came to order and then they went out in recess. So they were actually in session. And that, you know, you don't have to go beyond that in order to see that it was a valid session. So that is the last that I had. But I think overall, my takeaway from this is that the writing on the wall is in neon. I don't know which ground it will be. I think it's probably most likely to be the happens to revise versus happens to exist. And I think probably more likely than that, it would be pro forma sessions. Although one of the curious things about that is, you know, it breaks the lease China in the sense that the only appointments you have to worry about then are the NLRB and Cordray to a lesser extent, since Cordray, I believe, has ratified his prior positions now that he's become confirmed. But the weird thing about that is the court says constantly that they are a court of review, not first view. And I'm not aware of any court that has even passed on the pro forma sessions issue, let alone agreed with you know, the challengers on it. And, you know, admittedly, in the healthcare cases, the Supreme Court there accepted an argument that I don't believe any lower court had. I don't know of any lower court decision that, you know, found a program invalid under the spending clause because it gave the federal government too much power over the states. The Supreme Court was the first court to do that. But at least in that case, the lower courts had addressed those issues. In this case, they don't have the benefit of a lower court opinion to base it on. So if they go off on pro forma sessions, it would be kind of uncharted waters in a lot of ways. And with that, I am available to answer any questions you might have. I apologize for going a mile a minute, but I had a lot of ground to cover, and I'm naturally a fast speaker anyway. So any questions?
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. Well, thank you very much for that excellent analysis, Mr. Elwood. We've got about 20 minutes left for your questions on the line. In a moment, we'll open the floor to our audience questions. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that star and the pound key. And when we get to your question, you will hear a prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. And we'll be answering questions in the order which they are asked. I'd like to remind you to please keep your questions as brief as possible and do make sure that you actually do ask a question when you get on the line.
Hey, John, this is Mike Stern. Thank you very much for your summary of the argument. I just have one quick question. It was reported, I think, in The Hill that Justice Kagan made some remark to the effect of the history is all on the Senate side rather than on the government side. What do you remember what she was remember making that remark and what she was referring to?
I think that one might have been about the I wonder if that's about the pro forma session side. Yes, I think that was about the pro forma session side, that when she said, when Verrilli said that we've reached stable equilibrium, her rejoinder was, if you're going to look at practice, you got to look at the practice for all three, and the practice is all on the Senate side on the pro forma recesses thing. That's my recollection, although I don't think there is a transcript up yet. I'm going on my own notes, and I was taking notes furiously, but I didn't get everything.
Great. Well, we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. That's star and the pound key.
Hi, this is Tuan Samahan. Just in response to Justice Kagan's question, there does seem to be some executive practice or viewpoint about what the pro forma sessions, to wit, the 2009 Elwood Memorandum. I won't ask what the contents of that are, but it seems to be one of the elements of the Frankfurter concurrence, if one's going to argue that history has put a gloss on ambiguous text, is that you have to be able to assess what prior presidents who have also sworn and taken oath, what their view was of these particular provisions. And sort of the administration's played cat and mouse with this, because we don't actually have the Elwood Memorandum. We're just told by Virginia Seitz's memorandum, somewhat teasingly, that they were drawing from that conclusion. Do you think that the administration is going to be inclined to acquiesce, just assume that prior administrations were in accord with the Obama administration's position?
SG, as you probably are aware, resisted, because the challengers tried to argue that, President Bush, they tried to say that there was actually an affirmative, presidential acquiescence. And they tried to beat that back. And because they didn't want to invoke the, notorious Elwood Memorandum, they instead invoked the Elwood op-ed with Steve Bradbury in the Washington Post. To suggest that, they were doing their best to try to suggest that that's what the Bush administration actually thought. Personally, I think that what matters is more, I guess that maybe for the framers, you care about what they wrote about privately. But I think that, sort of executive public practice, I think public practice always kind of matters more than just what people said, especially nowadays. So I don't think I don't think they get a lot out of that. But we will see. I think that I think that the practice was so brief in any event that it really doesn't cut that much either way, in that it's only from 2007 to 2012 that this was going on, and 5 years is a relative heartbeat even in the history of as young a nation as ours.
Excellent. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. We've got one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open with about 15 minutes left to take questions. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key, star and the pound key.
Hi, John, thank you so much for this review. Victor Williams from Catholic Universities. I've been beating a political question drum now for about a year, hoping that the Solicitor General would try to make a alternative argument. Were those two words even whispered?
I don't recall a political question ever coming up consecutively. There was, you know, a lot of talk about sort of politics, but I don't believe the word political question was invoked. I may be wrong about that, but certainly there was no conventional discussion of whether this was a political question that, that the court didn't have the power to address. It seemed like they were definitely were inclined to address it.
All right, we've got two more questions on the line, and we'll go, or three questions on the line now, and we will go right to them.
How do you do? My name is Russ Stovall from Indiana, and quite interested in a little more detail of how you think the change in Senate procedure as to the filibuster could impact this decision, if you will, please.
You know, there were, I guess that there were some statements made, I think, by Miguel Estrada, and I think by at least one of the justices, although the name escapes me, noting that they worked it out. I guess it was Breyer, that they worked it out. And all that was really said along those lines was they worked it out. I don't think there was really a lot of talk about the change in Senate procedure. So even though I have, speculated in the past, both, you know, in blog posts and on early on this call, there was nothing in particular about the argument today that suggested that they thought that that was particularly relevant. But that doesn't mean that it won't make an appearance in the opinion. But I do think that it may have been on their minds, the fact that it does sort of undermine, it even more kind of undermines the idea that this is necessary for emergencies.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll move to our next question. Are you there, caller? All right, seems like we've lost our next question.
Hello, I'm here. Oh. Sorry, I had my mute button on. It's Michael Hertz. The transcript is actually now up on the court site.
Great.
So I am looking at it just to figure out what the Kagan history comment was. And
right.
So what she said was, Verrilli's argument about the history of what happens means is strong on his side, but history cuts other ways. And so it's what she specifically said was the third argument, the pro forma sessions argument, quote, the history is entirely on the Senate side, not on your side.
Right.
She thought the history was supportive on the happens, and the specific comment was wholly against him, specifically on the pro forma sessions point.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for clearing that up, by the way, since I had to just go on my recollection.
We've got two more questions and a little more than 10 minutes left, so we should be able to get to both those and possibly one or two more. So, again, if you've got a final question you'd like to ask, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Glenn Taubman from the National Right to Work Foundation. I attended the argument, and I just want to say great job summarizing it and putting all those points out there in a very good way, because I think your summary was just perfect for how the argument went.
I feel less bad about taking 40 minutes now.
No. You did a great job. I wasn't taking notes, as I'm sure you were, but it was a very accurate summary of the whole thing. So I just quickly would make one point in response to Professor Williams' call, who said he's been beating the drum about this is a non-justiciable political question. I felt as though Breyer, you know, when he was talking about this being sort of a political issue, I thought he was sort of channeling that, but saying there's no way that this is a non-justiciable political issue that we're going to avoid, that we have to. We're the only people left who can take care of this problem. So I think there was some recognition of that argument, but I think it was basically, they basically said, well, No, it's not non-justiciable, and it's not something we can ignore. I mean, that was my sense of what Breyer's comments were in a few different places where he talked about this being a political issue, but not one that they could avoid. But now I'd like to get to my question really quickly, which was, you ended your summary by saying that the court is in a little bit of a pickle because the pro forma issue hadn't been addressed below, and how, you know, they're really a court of review and so on. But, you know, they specifically added the question, and I mean, to my way of thinking, that's the easiest way out for them, is to decide it on the pro forma issue, because then they don't have to interpret structural, textual, constitutional words like recess and session. And don't you think that at the end of the day, when they go back into the chambers, they go, hey, we don't want to mess with the Constitution. We have an easy way out. And don't you think that's just the way they're going
to
go?
I think there is a lot to be said for that, because you are exactly right that that gets them around the most. I mean, it's kind of the clearest way forward, because you're right. You don't have to figure out what, you know, these words mean, and you don't have to interpret the sometimes ambiguous and sometimes contradictory historical evidence. It seems like a relatively easy point to make. You know, my only point there is that, and it is formally preserved because, you know, the court, it really only matters in federal cases as opposed to a jurisdictional matter, whether it might have, you know, been raised in a state case. But here their practices, the Supreme Court's practices, they will address something if it was pressed or passed on below, and it was certainly pressed below. And so that, you know, is something that they could address, but it is frequently not something that the court does address, that they will be the first court anywhere to address a question. But I do think that it is probably the easiest question for them to answer. It breaks the least china, and it may really be the kind of path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. If they go off on that grounds, though, I mean, one thing that is kind of interesting, as I kind of intimated at the beginning, there will be the cloud out there of, you know, the D.C. Circuit, Fourth Circuit, and Third Circuit all having held, you know, on the inter-intra ground, and the D.C. Circuit also on the happens to arise versus happens to exist ground. And I think both of those issues now would still be the subject to a circuit split. So if there is ever a recess, an opportunity to make another recess appointment, and I don't think there will be, because if they recognize pro forma recesses, then, you know, practically, I think that the president won't be able to, there will be pro forma sessions as long as both houses of Congress aren't in the hands of the other party. I think that there would be a circuit split existing still that would be the basis for certiorari on one of the remaining questions.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's. I would also add that, you know, there's a few live challenges to the Becker recess appointment, the Craig Becker recess mm-hmm. appointment, which I think goes back to, I forget what year that was,
mm-hmm.
09 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they go this pro forma route, they don't necessarily answer what happens in those cases. So
that's right.
This may not be the end of the recess appointment issue, no matter what they do.
Yeah. Yeah, I would be very interested. I mean, they could theoretically, they have a lot of cases being held for this. And I wonder if there is a Becker case right behind it that's being held now, you're saying?
Yes.
Because that's the thing is, I mean, in theory, they could grant that case the day they decide, or, you know, in the wake of this case. Whenever this case is decided, they could grant the Becker case. I think it's probably more likely that they'll GVR it, but, you know, maybe not. Maybe they won't feel that that will take care of the Becker recess appointment.
Well,
you know?
They have to. There's an amicus brief out there that specifically raises it, and I know that it's out there. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's a live issue somewhere. So
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And if any listeners have a copy of that brief and they could email it to me, I'd love to see it.
It's.
This is Christian again. I believe the system cut off our caller, but we do have two questions left that I think we can get to, so I would ask our final two questioners to please keep your questions as brief as possible, and we'll try to get to both of them before the end of the hour.
I'm Jim Markowski, an attorney in New York. So as a practical matter, will this decision, if it is held to be unconstitutional, allow parties to challenge actions, orders, and rulings of the NLRB with these improper appointments?
Yes, I certainly believe so. It seems like under the fairly recent precedent of the court, I forget the name, but I mean, just a couple terms ago when Elena Kagan was Solicitor General, it seems like they would be subject to challenge because they were not, you know, they were actions taken by improperly appointed board members. So I think that they'll probably have to, I think that a huge number or a significant number of orders will be vacated. And then the now properly constituted NLRB will have to figure out what they're going to do with them.
All right. Looks like we have time to squeeze in one final question. Is our caller still there?
Hello?
Yes, you're
yeah,
on.
I'm sorry, my mute button was on. John, this is Jerry Hunter in St. Louis, Missouri. In light of Glenn's question, and particularly in reference to Chief Justice Roberts' decision in the Patient Protection and Affordable Act case a couple of sessions ago, I've been wondering if the Chief Justice may be looking for a way to duck a decision here. And as you may recall, the D.C. Circuit found that the respondent here did not have to raise the issue of the unconstitutionality of the recess appointments before the board. Now, the statute says that any issue not raised before the board cannot be raised in the Court of Appeals. Do you was that issue raised at all? And in the oral argument as to the fact that this issue allegedly was not raised before the board in the Noel Canning case on the whether the recess appointments were constitutional, and if it was or if it was not raised, any likelihood that someone is going to try to hang their hat on that issue to avoid a decision here?
You know, it wasn't mentioned, and I don't see a lot of appetite for ducking this. You know, there's sometimes where you see the justices, and they clearly are concerned about the implications of where a ruling that they seem to be, you know, clearly confronting, where you can see them eager to duck an issue. I have to say I didn't see it. And even if they ducked it in this case, you know, there are cases behind it in line, and I don't think they would be able to duck it for very long. And I think that they will view this as a very good case for decision and that it was very well briefed and argued. And I feel like they probably feel like it is as well teed up as it's ever going to be. And, you know, ordinarily when cases disappear like that or disappear based on some non-merits ground, they usually get some significant airtime at argument. And as I say, I just didn't hear anything about that in the argument. And, you know, the fact that people who seem to be somewhat sympathetic to the Solicitor General's position, I could see them, you know, maybe bringing that up if they thought that it would stave off an adverse position or an adverse decision. But they didn't. And, you know, the fact that it includes people who are always extraordinarily well-prepared, like Justice Sotomayor, is a suggestion to me that there isn't a lot of appetite for going there.
Great. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again, and we've reached the end of the hour. I want to add in one side note. We heard from Professor Victor Williams earlier. Last week, the Federalist Society co-sponsored a debate with the Cato Institute over this case between Professor Williams and Professor Nicholas Quinn Rosenkranz from Georgetown University. And if you're interested in that debate, you can go to the Cato website where you can view that debate in its entirety for more information about the case. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our expert, Mr. Elwood. Thank you all to our audience for calling in and spending the hour with us and for your questions. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And please do join us for our next call tomorrow, Tuesday, January 14th at 2 p.m. Eastern, when we'll host a discussion on rails to trails, who owns the property interest, as well as another call after that on Wednesday, January 15th at 2 p.m. on McCullen versus Coakley case at the Supreme Court, and another Courthouse Steps teleforum featuring Carrie Severino. So thank you all very much, and until then, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.